Hi, I'm David Manti, and welcome to a new episode of the Today in Manufacturing podcast. With me this week are Jeff Franke and Anna Wells. We each have more than 15 years of experience covering the manufacturing industry. Every week, we take the five most popular stories on our websites and discuss the implications they have on the industry moving forward. Before we get started, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You could also help us out a lot by leaving the podcast a positive review on whatever platform you use, except Google Podcasts, because they're killing that one. If you want to email the podcast, you can reach any of us at Jeff, David, or Anna at IEN.com with email the podcast in the subject line. We're also live every Thursday at 2 p.m. So subscribe to at IEN Magazine on YouTube, and you can join us every week as we go live and mix it up with Doug and Mark and Jim. Who else is there normally? John.
Who's not there?
Yeah, who's not there?
Yeah.
Don't be the one that's not there. Jeff, how are you doing this week?
I am great, David. How about you?
I'm doing pretty good. Embracing the pie day. Anna, how are you?
Yeah, pizza for lunch. Pie day. That was exciting. I forgot about pie day, and then someone reminded me today, and I was like, yes, I could just get a free pass for whatever I want to do.
No, the...
That's round.
I couldn't believe you're eating all that pepperoni pizza.
Jeff, come on.
The only thing that was disappointing was that the availability of four delivery pies within our delivery network was just very, well, it was none. It was none.
It got here?
Yeah. Oh, well, no. I mean, the pizza got here. Mm-hmm. Like an actual pie. Like,
Yes.
This is how the entire conversation started. Was like, pies you like, pies you dislike. Can we get pies to the office?
What's the most disliked pie? Curious.
I don't know. For me, it's like all but pecan. And then everyone was just kind of like throwing out pies. Like, do you like this one? I'm like, still a no. Mm-hmm. Smells great being made. Hard pass. Still a hard pass. How about you? What's your, do you have like a favorite, least favorite?
I'm not super into pie either. Yeah. I also like pecan and like maybe like a nice chocolate, like a cream pie or something. But cooked fruit is not really my thing. So
see, there we go. We're at least we can meet on that level.
For once, we agree on something.
Yeah, we did consider like how long it would take to cook one of those like Costco pizza-sized meat pies in the pizza oven. Oof. Like maybe 5 to 6 hours, but I'm willing to accept that challenge. Jeff, do you have a favorite, least favorite pie?
I love pie. Love them all. Blueberry. Okay. My mom makes a pumpkin cream pie. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's the one where I can have a slice of pumpkin pie and enjoy it. Embrace Pi Day. All right. Well, before we jump into our first story this week, we have a word from our sponsor, Ovacy MDT.
My name is Jeff Franke. I'm the editorial director for Manufacturing.net, Industrial Equipment News, and Manufacturing Business Technology. I'll be joined by Dave McGovern and James Englehart from Ovacy MDT to discuss various topics and provide takeaways on how you can be more efficient in the areas of OT data management control, version control, vulnerability protection, and much more. It's my pleasure to introduce Dave and Jim. Dave McGowan has 10 years of experience providing automation, change management, and disaster recovery solutions. He manages some of Ovacy MDT's largest enterprise accounts and is especially passionate about helping customers implement the best OT backup and cybersecurity strategies. Jim Englehart has been working in the controls world for 35 years. He has a BS in both chemical engineering and electrical engineering and has worked in the refining and chemical, engineering consulting, and food and beverage areas before settling in as head of pre-sales engineering, professional services, and support for the Americas at Ovacy MDT. He's also a member of the Ovacy MDT product team.
The Secrets of OT Data Management is an exclusive new video podcast for manufacturers looking to stay ahead of the curve in today's digital landscape. So join Ovacy MDT's Dave McGovern and Jim Englehart, along with our Jeff Ranke, as they unveil the secrets of data management for manufacturers. Learn effective OT data management, control, cybersecurity, implementation, shortcuts, and more. Watch it now. All right, our first story this week. Automaker Rivian pauses construction of its $5 billion electric truck plant in Georgia. Last Thursday, Rivian CEO RJ Scaringe said the electric truck maker will once again stop construction on a $5 billion manufacturing plant in Georgia. The original plan was to make the R2 midsize SUVs at the factory, and the government kicked in some $1.5 billion to make it happen. But now, the plan is to move R2 production to the company's plant in Normal, Illinois, to get the vehicles to market sooner, sometime in 2026. In the meantime, Rivian will save about $2.25 billion, which, is important for a car maker burning through cash and already missing production targets in Illinois. Scaringe did provide a little insight, announcing the R3 and R3X crossover models, and he says, quote, "Our Georgia site remains really important to us." As for when construction will restart, Rivian said, later. Georgia's $1.5 billion incentive package was one of the largest ever offered for an American auto plant. Anna, will the people east of Atlanta ever get their plant?
Not anytime soon, in my opinion. You know, you mentioned the new vehicle launches. I think this is absolutely tied to that, specifically to the fact that Rivian has lowered the price of entry in a very significant way on the newest vehicles that it's producing. If you look at what RJ Scaringe has said about the R2 and the R3 and the R3X, they're slated to start around $45,000, the R2. This price point represents a huge shift away from what Rivian is bringing to market now. Their larger SUV, the R1S, I think it's called, is about $30,000 higher than that.
Yeah.
And honestly, it also outdoes some of the competition in that market segment. Smaller SUVs on the market, pairing that lower price tag with still a very good range. Rivian's known for having good battery range on its vehicles. They say that this smaller SUV is going to have a 300 mile per charge battery. This is a good deal for consumers if Rivian can pull it off. But they have to make some big changes to their operating model in order to, as you said, stop burning cash.
Yeah.
You know, Scaringe told Wired some kind of vague things about relying on smart engineering and, quote, snipping manufacturing and materials costs wherever they can. And I'd say this plant pause is a big snip.
Yeah, that's a $2.25 billion snip?
Yeah, just a little snip.
Just a little off the top.
But it does seem like it's necessary for a company that's pledged to bring to market a vehicle that is, what, 40% lower cost than their current cheapest model. That's not an easy thing to do for any automaker, let alone one that's, you know, comparatively new to the game. Mm-hmm. To put into perspective the difference in scale, Rivian set a new record in its 2023 Q4 with 17,541 vehicles delivered. GM delivered more than 625,000. So getting into these price wars is a far more painful endeavor for a company like Rivian than it is for an established automaker. Mm-hmm. So we can't expect that these types of market moves are going to are going to be done without some collateral damage here. I think we need, you know, Rivian has to make some very significant cost cuts to be able to function on this. It's just not possible otherwise to bring those vehicles to market at such a dramatically lower price and expect that they're going to be able to continue to operate.
Well, isn't part of it too that, I mean, just the scale of a $5 billion build out to get the R2 out the door, like they need these cars to hit the market sooner.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's another thing. And so if you're like sitting on that project waiting for it to happen whilst also dumping a ton of money on top of it, and then you have all these other fish to fry, you're right. They need to be there now. They don't have time to fool around for 2 years. And to be honest, their investors are not going to let them continue to burn through money without recouping some of that. And their plan to do so is with this lower price model. They just got to get it out.
Talking about the share prices, Jeff, they went up 13% because of the R3 and the R3X announcements. That means, you know, shares are now at 12 and about 12 and a half when they were once nearly $101 a share. But do you think that will hold? Is this just a, you know, sort of a temporary fix for Rivian? And what do you think about whether or not that facility is actually going to happen near Atlanta?
It's a really interesting convergence of a number of different factors. First of all, there's still a lot of backlash against this facility actually being built. Yeah. Okay, a lot of folks, we talked about this when it was being built. We talked about all of the funding that was being allocated towards it on a local level. Not everybody was for that. I mean, we still hear there was reference in the article to a lot of issues with water drainage and how that's not going to get better once you have this huge manufacturing campus in place. Mm-hmm. So there is still not an overwhelming amount of public support, I guess you could say, for this in this particular location. So you've got that dynamic here that's sort of maybe not working for it, I guess you would say, and things coming to fruition. The other thing is when you look at just the market factors, you know, we've talked a lot about EVs and how there's sort of been a cooling. Well, putting that in perspective, we saw in 2023 a 40% increase in EV sales. That's a huge number.
Yeah.
So when we look at 2024, 2025, and they're saying that number is going to go down to 30 or 25%, most markets would be ecstatic if you're looking at that level of growth.
Yeah.
But it's 10 to 15% less than it was the year previous. So there's that fall off. And if we're trying to get to like a 50, 60% by 2030, we're not scaling that way right now. So I think that plays a big part into what Rivian is doing here as well. And it's unfortunate because really they've had production issues. Mm-hmm. There have been some things that have come to fruition. But when you look at the fact that they've put 50,000 vehicles out the door and the amount of issues they've had coming back, it's really, I think, been a win from a quality perspective. I don't think Rivian has huge concerns with the product itself. But when you come out and you double production and deliveries by almost 150% year over year, mm-hmm. and you're not scaling fast enough, that's a really interesting economic challenge to try to hit, especially when you've talked about scaling up to 200,000 vehicles a year from a production perspective.
Yeah.
And that was done, you know, and Anna alluded to it, and so did you, in terms of the stock prices. They were trying to get funding. They were trying to get more people behind this, build up their stock price, build up their valuation. That's how you get all of that critical financing to scale up to do that. And with the stock price dropping, they have to do something. They had to come out and be positive about the new vehicle launches, but also show some economic responsibility or fiscal responsibility in terms of halting this huge billion-dollar project down in Atlanta. So it was a convergence of a lot of things. I think the outlook for Rivian is still positive. Mm-hmm. I think this plant down in Atlanta is still going to happen.
Yeah.
Not sure when. I mean, there's already too much in place. I think the local officials there would look really bad. I mean, we saw this with Foxconn here in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
When you've got this huge build out and you've got this tiny building that's actually doing something.
Yeah.
And that's what they are facing here. I like I said, I think there is going to be the scale up. I think Rivian has done enough good things to justify this facility. Is it going to be 7,500 workers? That I don't think. I think it's going to be a smaller amount than that. I don't think they're going to meet all the requirements for hitting all the economic conditions that they got that, what was it, $1.5 billion for.
Yeah.
I think that will be scaled back, but there will be something there, I would say, in the next 2 to 3 years.
Well, and there are a couple of things there, Jeff. Like, one, talking about growing pains, I mean, it's good to see an EV automaker with the good kind of growing pains, but growing pains are still growing pains, and it's like difficult for them to navigate and like maybe try and find the other side. You're right. That site was supposed to create 7,500 jobs, make 200,000 vehicles. When the first phase was completed later this year, then there was the second phase, which was supposed to be done by 2030 and add an additional 200,000 vehicles per year. Now, you talk about the investment, and that's by the local governments. And that's kind of what like sticks with me, because you talk about how public sentiment was already kind of against this quite a bit. And now state and local governments have already spent more than $125 million to buy the 2,000-acre site. They cleared trees from it. They graded the land. That work is done, mm-hmm. and the site was already turned over to Rivian. The state also completed most of a $50 million project in road work. You know, and then they also gave Rivian a little bit more of a breather by extending it to the incentives package to 2030 to hit some of those goals. But I can't imagine that the people are going to be as patient when it comes to like, all right. I mean, as you said, like with Foxconn, like, hey, we did our part. You know, we cleared it. We bought it. We got it for you.
Mm-hmm.
Do something with it. Put a nice skate park on there in the interim. You know, something. I just think that public sentiment might continue to shift. And I don't know. But hopefully Rivian stays going in the positive direction. Because Rivian still has the Amazon deal, right? So,
Yeah.
Okay. So
I think the one thing that helps the overall future status of this plan too is there's a very strong automotive infrastructure within the state of Georgia as mm-hmm. well. I mean, I think it's the Hyundai plant over in Savannah that's actually growing still. So there is that, which is important for the automotive production.
And that was, I mean, there was a lot of talk about how closely tied the current administration is to the success and failure of this particular plant and what it might look for, or what it might look like. So a lot of people have a lot of eggs in this Rivian basket, and people might not be willing to wait around until 2030 to see cars start coming off the line. All right, our next most popular story this week. Tyson is closing an Iowa pork plant. Tyson Foods is streamlining operations. The next phase means 1,200 people in Perry, Iowa, will be out of work as Tyson shutters a pork plant. The plant was the biggest employer in town, which has a population of just under 8,000. The announcement came on Monday, and the company said it will work with officials to help those laid off, but the company didn't share to what extent. As always, workers are encouraged to apply for openings at its other plants. And just 6 years ago, Tyson got about $674,000 in incentives to help pay for $44 million in plant upgrades. A Tyson spokesperson said, quote, "While this decision was not easy, it emphasizes our focus to optimize the efficiency of our operations to best serve our customers. We understand the impact of this decision on our team members and the local community." Anna, I don't know if Tyson really did understand the impact on this particular community because it has suffered some recent tragedies. And it is just, I don't know, sometimes when you hear these statements from spokespeople, they come out so tone deaf, especially when we're talking about cutting what is the equivalent of 15% of the town's population.
Yeah, exactly. I know it's hard to, when you feel like the situation's being glossed over and the officials are like, "Hey, look, this is solvable. We can fix this just by, you know, new jobs."
Yeah, but new jobs. But like the one thing that stood out to me too about that was like, it made me think of the Oscar Mayer plant in Madison, where like when they left, everyone's like, "Everything's going to be fine. We got a lot of people coming in, a lot of people coming in to check it out." And man, every time when I pass that to softball, I'm just like, still empty, still a lot of weeds growing in the parking lot.
Yeah, it does. It takes a lot of effort, I think, when something like this happens. So Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds came out pretty much immediately with a response saying that the Tyson employees, the Perry community, and Iowa pork producers would have the full support of the state. She added that the Iowa Economic Development Authority and Iowa Workforce Development stand ready to assist impacted employees with finding new jobs in the area as soon as possible. She also noted that there are more than 60,000 job openings on iowaworks.gov.
It rolls off the tongue.
Iowa Works. I said that right, I think. Mm-hmm. Iowa Works. Local news station Channel 13 pointed out that they did a search of the Iowa Works website and found 348 available positions within 10 miles of Perry. That list included 9 positions at the soon-to-be-shuttered Tyson Foods plant in Perry. So say, you know, 340-ish in the immediate area, not quite touching the number of people that are being laid off. I can appreciate the governor making a statement here, of course, but I just think it illustrates how these kind of incidents aren't as easily fixed as we want to think that they are. You know, not all opportunities are the same. Not all these jobs are going to be the same. They're not going to be a perfect match for people's skill sets or, you know, availability. It's just, it's easier said than done. Mm-hmm. And it's not just about the jobs. It's about the loss of the tax revenue incurred by the community. It's the downstream impacts to other businesses where 1,200 people aren't spending their money on lunch and gas and coffee in that region. It's blight also, you know. There's a lot to consider. Unfortunately, I just don't think it can all be solved by here is a list of new jobs in our state or here's a career counselor. Best of luck to you, which is typically how these things go. And, you know, that's just not going to be enough to stave off some of these other related issues. And so I think states need to be working contingency plans, I think, into some of their business recruitment initiatives, because we see this happen so often and often without warning. You know, 6 years ago, this plant, Tyson spent $44 million to upgrade it. You know, we've seen way faster falls than that. Mm-hmm. And especially when you're in a rural area, there's not always a bounce back. You know, we've seen that in towns in our area where these plants sit forever empty. They fall into disrepair. The city's on the hook to remediate the environmental damage, and you know they have to tear them down at millions of dollars in cost because they're so dangerous to have sitting there. I mean, like, that happens a lot. Yeah. So trying to look past just the like, hey, I'm sure maybe we can find some jobs for some of these people that are maybe equivalent, but we don't really know. Mm-hmm. I know they're trying to make it look like they have a handle on it and that it's going to be okay. But it's not a good situation.
No, Janesville, Wisconsin. To your point, hopefully the community can rally. But I mean, it's something like this that could kill a community. When you talk about some of those downstream effects, you know, trucking companies, other pork producers in the area, feed suppliers in the area, mm-hmm. a lot of them are all going to take the hit. And Jeff, I mean, yes, they do have a site. Oh, and one other point I wanted to say, and it was that like a lot of times, and we're guilty of it too, is we say like, hey, as long as you're, you have manufacturing skills, there's never been a better time to find another position. But sometimes like the logistics of that.
The logistics, right. And people, you know, people own homes, like, and maybe that's not so easy to unload at the price that you want to move to a community that is otherwise a 45, 50 minute commute there and then back. Like, it's just, there's more to it. Like, your kids go to school in that town and no one can pick them up. Like, it's not so easy to say like, well, just find another job. I'm sure there's plenty around there. Yeah. There's more to it.
Yeah. Really, you're lucky to be laid off now. Mm-hmm. So, Jeff, they have the site and they do have the workers, as we said, but it has been kind of an increasingly competitive landscape. And this is a 384,000 square foot pork processing plant. And I can't imagine that that is something that is easy to retrofit for anything other than pork, maybe food related. You know, it's not like they're going to turn around and turn this into a furniture manufacturing facility.
I mean, if you're going to go that route, it's easier to go from food to something else than from something else to food. Yeah. Because you have to have all those hygienic considerations and everything else in there. Different types of material handling equipment that is more specific to that product. So I think you could go the other way more easily. I think what I was really focused on here a little bit was just Tyson itself and kind of disappointed in a company this size not being able to handle some of the, and granted, it's been a very uneven ebb and flow when you look at supply chain right now coming out of COVID, especially for food processors. We've talked about this a number of times, how the margins are super tight. Mm-hmm. A lot of the big players in this specific industry faced the need to increase wages for their workers.
Yeah.
But then they also didn't account for the fact that everybody was at home, eating from home, prices for meat products went up.
Yeah.
They could charge more for them and they were selling a lot more. Coming out of COVID, then everybody's like, hey, we don't have to sit at home anymore. Plus, there's a lot of different options in this particular product mm-hmm. sector. So, I mean, Tyson has been shutting down a fair number of plants in the last year. They lost over almost $400 million the last quarter. Couple this with the fact that they have been paying people more. And as recently as 2022, I mean, they were touting on their website how they paid more than $50 million in what they call thank you bonuses and over $100 million in wage increases to hourly workers. So when you factor in the fact that you're selling less stuff mm-hmm. at a lower price than you were before, and then you're paying your workers more, this stuff is going to happen. But there should have been greater foresight, in my opinion, on Tyson's side to see some of these things coming and adjust sooner to avoid these sort of dramatic layoffs mm-hmm. There just have been greater foresight. I mean, we talk a lot about this in a lot of the white papers we cover and some of the other things that we do for some of our clients where they're touting these solutions focused on using tools like artificial intelligence and other data-driven products to help forecast and control your supply chain to avoid these types of situations because this is going to turn. The demand is going to come back. Mm-hmm. Tyson is going to recoup at some point, and then they're going to be struggling to find workers and find themselves in a very similar situation where they can't bring in people at the right price point mm-hmm. because everything else is competing with them throughout manufacturing for these workers. So it's disappointing for a company that size to face this type of situation repeatedly over the course of the last 12 to 18 months. The other thing that really caught my attention, and I did not understand, this was in a USA Today article where they talked about one of the reasons that they targeted this plant for shutdown was because of its size and age made it difficult to add a second shift.
What? I don't know.
I
don't know. Maybe what does it's that mean? Too big. Like, I have no idea. Like,
I mean, you're talking about tone deaf before.
Yeah.
That really, what?
I don't know. Like, maybe it's too big to add a second shift with maybe that was like pared down stuff. I don't know. I cannot understand.
Plus, you're shutting a place down and you're saying, well, we couldn't expand there, so we had to shut it down.
Yeah. Well, and also, did you say the age of it? I mean, they just put $44 million into it right. 6 years ago. So that was the other thing is that they had just made such a significant investment. Because at first, I was going to kind of harp on how like the city put out $680,000 into it. so they could keep it open. Only bought 6 years. But I mean, Tyson dropped $44 million. You would think that with that kind of investment 6 years ago, like they could find a way to make this facility work.
Yeah. Did not. A lot of weird comments coming out of a company that should just know better.
One, I don't know. One thing that stood out to me is that it's a pork plant. And you talk about how things were so inflated during COVID. Like pork prices during COVID were so bananas that you could not buy pork outside of like suppliers like Tyson. Yeah. Because all the places I would normally go to buy like a whole pig or a half of a pig, they were all selling to the Tysons of the world because the margins were so high. Yeah. And you're right. Like if they couldn't have the foresight that that was going to come down a little bit or that the market was going to adjust, it's shocking. And you think that maybe there's something else going on that would cause them to make that decision. Christy Hupp, who is a resident in town, she talked to the Des Moines Register and she said the closure was the second, quote, disaster of a lifetime that this community has experienced in just 2 months. And that is a reference to the deadly shooting that happened at a local high school in January. Multiple residents did come out, though, and say that they are very resilient in Perry, which I found very encouraging. And then if you kind of look at the timeline, you know, so this was a meatpacking plant in the mid-50s that closed. And then Iowa Pork Company built a new plant, which is now the current Tyson factory. Oscar Mayer actually bought that plant in 1965 and then sold it on Christmas Eve, 1988, to IBP. Just like, Merry Christmas! You have a new logo on your pay stamp or on your, yeah, pay stamp. Tyson acquired IBP in 2001. So this has happened. Similar changes or disruptions have happened in the town's past. They have been resilient and hopefully they can maintain that legacy. All right. Our next most popular story this week. CEO faces up to 30 years in prison for selling fake medical implants. Laura Perryman is the former CEO of Stimwave, a medical device company that designed and sold implantable neural stimulation devices for treating chronic pain. Perryman is now facing prison after being found guilty of manufacturing and distributing fake medical implants. The controversy surrounds the StimQ PNS system, which had electrodes and a receiver that allowed it to transmit energy from an external power source to a, quote, pink stylet. Stimwave sold the StimQ to doctors for some $16,000 and then told them to bill insurance providers $16,000 to $24,000 for implanting the device. However, physicians were having trouble implanting the pink stylet in certain patients because it was too long. This is all according to the Department of Justice. Perryman, the CEO, knew the pink stylet could not be cut or trimmed without damaging the receiver, but instead of coming up with a functional solution, Stimwave created a white stylet, which was made entirely of plastic, but it could be cut to size. The problem also was that the white stylet didn't do anything. Perryman even oversaw training that suggested to doctors that the white stylet was a, quote, receiver and convinced employees to vouch for the system. U.S. Attorney Damian Williams said, quote, Perryman brazenly created a dummy medical device component. Perryman was convicted of one count of healthcare fraud, which carries a max sentence of 10 years in prison, and one count of conspiracy to commit healthcare fraud and wire fraud, which carries a max sentence of 20 years in prison. So, Jeff, throw the book at her, right?
I was impressed with the fact that the DOJ was coming down with like 30 years in prison. Mm-hmm. And then the SEC, I think Anna's going to talk a little bit about that. They're coming after her as well. It does feel like maybe we learned a little something here. I mean, reading this, I couldn't help but think about Theranos and Elizabeth Holmes.
Oh, yeah.
And everything that happened there. And the fact that if they could have gotten onto her sooner, how much that would have avoided in terms of just all the false hopes, I guess. I mean, fortunately, that didn't get to a clinical level where people were depending on that to the point where, I mean, this woman even had Joe Montana posing with her as far as like a case study, I guess you could say. So, yeah. I mean, it's crazy, especially when you look at the fact that her original product worked. She just did not want to take that next step in terms of enhancing and upgrading and making it customizable for everybody else.
Yeah, Theranos defrauded investors, which I understand, lies, money, bad. But this one, we're implanting like phony medical devices in people that need chronic pain treatment. That is
dirty. Especially when you, yeah, I mean, when you see what it could do when it worked, when the pink one was used, it worked.
Yeah.
And there was nothing, you know, it got me too, you know, you make fun of me about that thing that leads to the thing, but I can imagine doing this story back in 2010 when this came out, thinking about, wow,
yeah, mm-hmm.
what else can we do here? Anybody who knows anyone who suffers with, you know, arthritis pains or joint pains or anything else, you could see this being a solution, and then also having the promise of that solution and then getting the phony one mm-hmm. basically implanted into your body.
Yeah.
I mean, let's not just sidestep that. It wasn't just that it didn't work. I don't care how minimally invasive of a procedure it is.
Mm-hmm.
You're putting a foreign object under the skin of your body.
Yeah.
That is never a minor thing. And there's always risk for infection and everything else that can happen there. So you just wonder how sort of how these people just can detach themselves from those. I'm trying to think of the word, what they call
those
people.
They're psychotic.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, they're a sociopath.
Sociopath. That's what it is. This woman still has her own website too, by the way.
Yeah.
Which I was thinking about, how unfortunate if you share the same name. This woman, there are people. There's like a successful author and artist out there with the same name. So if somebody Googles her, they have to make sure they go to the right place. But she seems, even on her website, again, the picture of Joe Montana and touting herself as the founder of this product. The real detachment from reality there, obviously. And she's getting hers, which is good.
Well, and first of all, we do not make fun of you for the catchphrase. We embrace it and we call it our own, right?
Yeah, and we hashtagged it TTTITTWTH47.
It's a good one. But I mean, the other thing that for me, Jeff, is that when you talk about the implanting something fake into somebody, they were not receiving pain relief and their doctors were probably like thinking all of a sudden like it's a mental problem now. Like, you know, it's clearly a problem with the patient, not the device, because that happens all the time. Just like, hey, we did the procedure. It should be working. Maybe you have a mental problem. Anna, I like could not like when Ben Munson wrote this story and sent it across our desks, it was just like, I need to take a walk.
Yeah.
Because I'm so like angry and physically upset right now, because it's just, it's one thing, you know, to kind of fake it until you make it, but like she made it, she had it, and then she faked it instead of like saying like, hold off, we need to make a smaller one.
Yeah. And that was honestly maybe the most disturbing thing to me, is that she and this company, like, they didn't begin as charlatans. Like, this was a real deal medical device company that produced an actual functional product. And to your point, I thought that was a great point about, you know, chronic pain sufferers notoriously, you know, voice that they are not believed by their doctors, or, you know, that they suffer in silence for many years and people think it's, you know, neurological or psychological or whatever, but having nothing, it's just, it's disappointing, you know? And you look at somebody like Laura Perryman, who kind of took it upon herself to fabricate this new product in response to what sounds like a market need, all the lives that were impacted by this. And I think secondly, and, you know, I didn't think about this at first, but like, so Stimwave filed for Chapter 11 in 2022, and a company called Curonix, which is a peripheral nerve stimulation company, actually acquired Stimwave's assets late last year. Stimwave had voluntarily recalled this PNS device, but Curonix still offers a PNS system called Freedom PNS. It's great. And then you think about how many people probably look at this product and maybe it could be helpful to them. And they probably second guess that based on this entire scandal, thinking like, okay, the people at the helm of this product, you know, even the product managers and the designers and stuff who were so easily influenced by this person who ran the company, because she did kind of encourage them to lie about the functionality of this stylet, white stylet, which did nothing.
Yeah.
Which is like baffling to consider how you as a professional could be like, you know what? Yeah, this is fine. We should put this to market. It really causes you to second guess the capabilities of this company to begin with, and second guess the technology, even though by all reports, the original technology, I think, was fine.
Yeah.
It just didn't fit everybody.
Yeah.
So unfortunate too, that there's going to be some downstream to that of people saying like, you know what, I don't trust this technology, even though maybe they could. So I don't know. The other thing I wanted to add to this, and you mentioned this too, Jeff, you know, the consequences here were in this criminal case were important. There could be more coming down the line, which to me, I think is significant based on how brazen this was. But the SEC has its own case against Perryman for, much like Theranos, defrauding investors. Mm-hmm. Part of this was due to how she had allegedly repeatedly claimed to investors that the entire system was FDA cleared, when in fact the company had never submitted the white stylet for agency review. So outside of these criminal charges, I would assume that she will also be hit with a hefty financial penalty at some point here as well for the millions of dollars that came on this sort of false pretense of what this product could do and how it was regulated. So more to come. I think she deserves every penny and every day
coming,
for what she did here. This is just outrageous.
Do either of you see, was this brought by a whistleblower? Because you bring up a great point, Anna. Like, I mean, yeah, it's one thing for her to go down for encouraging employees to vouch for it, but it's another for the employees to be like, well, you know what? Laura said go with it. So, all right, we're selling the white stylet. I mean, there are salespeople, there are engineers, there are staff. I mean, even the marketer who had to create the brochure for the white stylet. Like, I feel like everyone's kind of complicit with this one.
Right. Like, how much did everyone know, and how are they responsible for that as well? Yeah, I don't know. I don't know exactly how this came down, but.
So the StimQ was a neurostimulator system designed to treat chronic pain by providing electrical currents to peripheral nerves. Now, it was big, part of the problem was that doctors were buying these, finding out that they wouldn't fit. That's the pink stylet. And then they were kind of stuck with the bill. And that's how all this kind of started to spiral. One of the things that could have very simply been done in the interim is Perryman also could have just lowered the price and made it easier for doctors to absorb the cost if and when they didn't work, or worked out a different plan other than, no, you know what, keep billing the insurance company. I had mentioned how many people suffer from chronic pain. Almost 21% of U.S. adults, that's 51.6 million people, experience chronic pain. 6.9% or 17.1 million people experience high impact chronic pain regularly. This is according to the CDC. So we're talking a lot of people. And we even had readers. We had a regular reader, I believe it's KJ, on the website say that his doctor recommended a device just like this to treat his chronic pain. And he, to your point, Anna, he said the same thing. He's just like, not only do I doubt this particular company, but I doubt the technology now.
Yeah.
I mean, even though, who knows, these people that are suffering pain, I know that, like, I recently saw how many opiates my grandmother was on, and I'm just like, oh my God, there's got to be a better way. You know, like, it's, they actually had a real solution to help people, and they kind of corrupted everything.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I also have personal friends who suffer chronic pain. And so I think that's why I was so mad about it, was I see what they go through day to day and how that takes a mental toll on them. And even being one of those people who is just like, I mean, are you sure it hurts that much all the time? Mm-hmm. Just because it's hard to imagine until you're in the same situation. And it's just the entire situation is vile and disgusting. All right, our next most popular story. Chinese EVs are getting weird. Kind of a hard transition there. Let's go fun now. All right. Is the Chinese EV market a wild west of innovation or a wall with various types of pasta in different stages of stick? They're in different stages of stick. China's new EVs have some ambitious offerings. And let's remember that they already have built-in karaoke systems and refrigerators. We previously saw BYD's U8, which has a body control system that allows it to drive on three wheels if you get a flat or a blowout, and it even offers up to 30 minutes of emergency flotation. Well, now the U8, which is about $150,000 US, can also deploy a drone from its roof to capture real-time aerial videos of the trip. The drone docks and charges itself upon arrival and is controlled by the infotainment system. Then there's the XPeng G9 SUV, which has a sleeping kit that flattens all of the seats and inflates an air mattress, you know, for a quick snooze. BYD also has a steering wheel that can be detached and used to play video games on the car's display. The driver uses the pedals for gameplay, but automakers insist the games only work when the car is stationary and the engine is off, which is important because you've taken the steering wheel off. EVs have even teased a car-mounted fishing system. Like, this is a full fishing system that you pull up to the lake and it kind of deploys the entire line. Like, I mean, it basically casts for you. It's just, I don't know how that's fishing. But they also have an in-car plant care system that harvests water from the roof in the car's cooling system. Jeff, when will enough be enough for Chinese EVs that are getting weird, man?
Yeah, those are pretty weird. I'll give you that. I think in a lot of this, I think what BYD is doing is they're sort of reasserting their place as the market leader in the biggest market for their product. Okay. When you look at Chinese EVs, I mean, that marketplace is four times the size of the US. They've been selling over 1 million electric vehicles since 2018. We just hit that mark last year. Okay. Yeah. So this is electric vehicles in China are a mature product. It's not like here where we're not sure where it's going to fit in and all this other stuff. Range anxiety, not a thing. Okay. That's the way their culture is built. So when you look at that, when you take it from that perspective, in terms of BYD being the biggest EV maker right now in the biggest market in the world, and they're also making inroads into Europe, they're throwing out some crazy stuff to maybe assert the fact that we are the leader.
Yeah.
Look at us. We've, you know, to use their sort of perspective, we've mastered the simple stuff. We've got this car thing down.
Yeah.
Let's make this about lifestyle. Let's make this about hitting any possible need you might want from your vehicle. I think that's where it's going. Is it weird? Yes. Okay. All this is completely unnecessary. It was not a misleading headline in any way, shape, or form. But again, I think that's what it is. Again, it's a different type of marketplace. They're the leader in it, and this is how they're sort of asserting that. I definitely had flashbacks to the Homer Simpson car, though, when you were mentioning some of this stuff. Like, the only thing they're missing is the bubble in the back seat for the kids, so you don't have to worry about listening to their arguing.
Man. You know what? Talk about looking at that episode with a different perspective these days. So I guess, Anna, to prepare this for the American market, all they need to do is, especially combined with the water harvesting system, they just need to like make it bulletproof, and then it can just be like a panic room on wheels, and that should be ideal for the American market.
Yikes. Yeah, I mean, I have looked at this in much the same way as Jeff did. To me, this is like, you know, if you're trying to tell a compelling story around design acumen and creature comforts and innovation, and you're doing so in a crowded market, then why not? You know, you know, as Jeff said, China is already way, way ahead of us. 25% of vehicles sold last year were fully electric. That was like 8.4 million EVs sold in 2023 in China. And BYD is the market leader there. So and they have good marks on battery range. Their portfolio is really workable. Even U.S. Drivers who've reviewed their vehicles say, you know what, they're actually pretty decent cars. I think if BYD wants to take a bit from Tesla and the rest of the competition that's out there, why not promote features that are putting you in a new bracket, making it so nobody can compare to you? And I think it's a smart play, honestly, that other automakers might consider getting more aggressive on, because I think a lot of them need to create almost a brand new brand identity for the EV market. Yeah, yeah. Because I think if you look at where some of these automakers are coming from, their legacy and their loyal customer base, that's not what's going to follow them into EVs. They may have to like walk away from that for the way they go to market in the EV space. Like, for example, you know, Dodge can't expect that their EVs are going to ride the coattails of the muscle car. That's a totally different thing. You know, Ford brand loyal diesel truck drivers might be totally different than the Lightning buyer. So you have to, I think in this case, even as a legacy automaker, start over a bit from a marketing standpoint, which makes it harder for them. But also, you have to find a way to distinguish yourself within that market, even if you have an old name. So for a company like BYD, getting weird means getting attention, making a brand for yourself, and maybe We see more of that altogether with automakers as they look to differentiate themselves going forward. I think actually that would be fun.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're right. Like, look at reservations that we had for the F-150 Lightning, electric versions of like the Charger, the Mustang. And then, you know, kind of once it got out there, sort of that normally crazed fan group was just like, oh, maybe not.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and, you know, think of it this way too. It's like, you ever see like a runway fashion show and pictures from that on TV and you're like, no one dresses like that. No one is going to buy that. This is the same thing. They're just like, they're just throwing out like, hey, this is cool. We can do this.
Look what we can do.
This is going to like maybe define our aesthetic in some way, but it's not really a representation of like the average vehicle that a person's actually going to buy.
I don't know which designer it was, but I saw photos from, they were basically wrapped in multiple tapestries and look like giant clouds walking down the runway.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, okay, if you let me just kind of go wild with my imagination for a while, this could be really fun. This could be a fun exercise. And just like, no, it's more of a, it's a high design concept. You know, you might not get it.
Yeah. You might not get it, David.
Well, actually, and, at some of those 3D printing shows, when they do the 3D printing fashion shows, those are wild. I mean, talk about like, I mean, when you have like an automated bodice, crazy things are happening. Just like it deploys wings. You're like, oh my God, totally necessary. And I'm into it. What's next? I also thought it was a good friendly reminder that like, you know, with the car deploying a drone, so that way you can also live stream your trip. I mean, it's a friendly reminder. You don't need to record everything. You don't need to. Like, I mean, we're a culture and a world now where it's just like the phone's up first and then you try to figure out what's going to happen in front of it.
David has officially become an old man.
Yeah.
So, good work.
I mean, put your phone down.
Welcome to the group.
You know what? I will say that normally that's my normal complaint. And thank you. I do feel warm. Yeah. Welcome here. This was the first show in a long time that I went to a couple weeks ago where everyone didn't have their phones out. And it might have been like I was saying, like mosh pit proximity. But it was nice. I mean, other than like fearing for the health of my knees, I was like, you know what? There aren't a bunch of phones in front of me right now. It's great. We're all just enjoying it. It's nice. It's nice because I was with a bunch of 40-somethings. Other features that kind of stood out. So apparently EVs can be so quiet that they give passengers motion sickness.
Oh, cute.
And so Geely gave its Galaxy E8 the ability to vibrate at 1.25 hertz. And that number didn't mean anything to me until they said it was the same as the human heartbeat. So They gave their car a human heartbeat so that way you don't get sick in it.
Isn't that how they make babies fall asleep with like the like white noise heartbeat?
Oh, I guess. Yeah. No, like, I mean,
be careful in there.
I mean,
stay alert, everyone.
Parents have been relying on the kids falling asleep and the babies falling asleep in the car for years. And this will just help that.
This will help.
Turn on the car's heartbeat. The Li Auto L series has built-in massagers, which again, talking about staying alert, it's hard to imagine that. I mean, I know that I fall asleep during every massage, so that's a problem. And the Rox Motor Polestone 1 has a rear-mounted kitchen and sun canopy combo. Kind of like you see that pop out of like those little, what are the small campers that, like the teardrop
trailer? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. It has a full kitchen, sun canopy, water source, just, you know, just in case. See, in here, I thought innovation was like when they put the handle on the like truck bed for old timers to get in there. Just like, oh, no, stairs come down. All right. This is the one for me. This is according to members of my family. All right. Well, the most popular story this week. GM and other major car makers are telling insurers how you drive. According to the New York Times, GM is narking on drivers. A Chevy Bolt driver was recently surprised to see his insurance rise by 21%. When he asked why, an insurance agent directed him to LexisNexis Risk Solutions, a data broker that provides information-based analytics for business customers. According to a consumer disclosure report from LexisNexis, GM had kept track of 640 trips the driver had made in the last 6 months. The report included dates, distances, start and end times, and every time the driver sped, braked hard, or accelerated sharply. It didn't show location, so hey, there was a little bit of privacy. GM sent the information to LexisNexis, which analyzed the data and created a, quote, risk score that insurers can use to determine coverage costs. And it's not just GM doing this. Kia, Hyundai, and Honda have started offering opt-in features in connected car apps that rate a person's driving. This information is sent to companies like LexisNexis and sold to insurance companies. While customers must consent, the language is often hidden in standard terms and conditions. For example, GM's OnStar Smart Driver feature, in this feature, the company says the service is optional and the information, quote, may be used to obtain insurance quotes. So, Anna, this story, like the one previously, got me a little fired up as well, just because there's something about opting. I think that there needs to be greater disclosure in terms of the information that is being collected on you and how it's being sold. But I thought this could be kind of a big black eye for major automakers as people are making decisions as to whether or not they want to buy new or used.
Yeah, it was funny. I read the comments underneath this story after it was posted, and I think every single comment used the term Big Brother.
Big Brother. I mean, this is the biggest of brothers.
This is the Big Brother.
This is your Big Brother riding next to you going like, you think you're going fast enough? Can you get closer? And I mean a Big Brother. I'm not talking about any other person in the world that would be saying this kind of thing. But like, can you get closer to the car in front of you? Did you need to take that turn so fast? Again, this is Big Brother.
Yeah.
This hypothetical person that doesn't ever sit next to me.
Right. Not a real brother. You're brother. Nothing wrong with your brothers.
Nothing wrong with my brothers. There are other people that sit in the passenger seat.
Yep. So look, I think like foundationally some things about this make sense, but the way it was executed was not my favorite. You have to look, I think, at what the objectives are. And for the insurer, that is to make sure that they don't spend more covering vehicle repairs and replacement than they get in return in insurance premiums. Very basic concept, makes sense, right? But to me, it was like, why not make this program much more above board and more carrot, less stick? Because ultimately, I think I'd rather know that my driving was being evaluated and, if good, lower my premiums versus getting unknowingly busted and then watch my rates go up. And when you do it that way, I think it feels like a trick and that it really angers people. And in this case, I think the average person understands what an insurer's business model is, but sneaking in consent in like the standard terms and conditions forms. And we all know that nobody reads that. And that is not lost on the automaker or the insurer. Yeah. They know that too.
Yeah.
And to me, that just feels like a gotcha. Like they don't want you to know until it's too late. And I know people are limited with insurance in some cases of who they can work with, but you are less limited with your auto brand of choice. And so there's going to be a whole contingent of people that I think would gladly seek out alternatives, to your point. And that's where they would choose to spend their money. And for a company like GM, you have to assume that this is a worthwhile revenue stream. However, consumer pushback could make the ROI on that a little bit trickier. So I think this is one of those things where it becomes a can of worms once it gets publicized and people start to think, oh, wait a second, what am I agreeing to when I sign?
The worms are out.
Yeah, and I'm not comfortable with that. And if enough people say that, then companies like GM are going to have to decide, is it worth it for the money that we're making to sell this data if people are saying, no thanks, GM, I'm not buying from you anymore.
Yeah, they got a Wendy's this, where they just came out and like, oh, no, we're thinking about it. Thinking about it. This made me think of your health insurance, right? How you can get a discount to go to the gym. And I'm just like, well, what if they put in the terms and conditions that they could see how often and for how long you would go to the gym and then use that information to raise your insurance premiums? And then I thought, oh my God, what if they're already doing that? Because that just sounds like the exact same thing that's already happening. So, conspiracy theories aside.
Could you be more paranoid about this one?
Wow. I am paranoid about it. So for me, my interpretation was enough already, but are people going to concede? Like, we are a market that trades on our data. So is this enough already? Or is this just another step where people are like, fine, take it. You know, I'm not doing anything wrong.
Well, I would agree. first of all, there needs to be greater transparency. There's no need to hide it in the terms and conditions. But two things are, you need to read that stuff. Okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're in that age where you do need to take a closer look at all that stuff. The other thing is, whether it's an app on your phone, the Bluetooth setting in your vehicle, or whatever the case is, any time you use one of those, you have to realize in this day and age, you're opening a door. Mm-hmm. And this, when you look at OnStar, it's tracking where your vehicle is located. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's an open door that can be hacked into, looked at in any way possible. So the more of this data-driven applications, mobility that we want and we want to utilize, we're leaving ourselves susceptible to this type of situation. Now, you shouldn't have to worry about General Motors pulling one over on you and selling your data to Nexus and insurance companies. I would agree there. Mm-hmm. But we do have to have this greater awareness. And when we talk about this type of data flowing in and out, yes, it can have a definitely negative ramification, which was this person here being surprised by a hike in their insurance cost. It can also have a positive ramification as well in terms of seeing identifying people who are safer drivers. Or if you have teenage drivers like me, maybe a little bit of, you know, if you want to call it big brother or whatever, people knowing that they're going to see when they are speeding, driving irresponsibly, and that's going to impact their insurance. That's not the worst thing either, mm-hmm. but it should be optional. I agree you should have to opt into it, but there are pluses and minuses to it. The other thing I'd throw out there is right now, if you have what is called or referred to in any way, shape, or form as a connected car, mm-hmm. in other words, you use Bluetooth,
yeah.
there can be upwards of 25 megabytes of data flowing out of your vehicle every hour. Mm-hmm. That's the equivalent of like 6,000 downloaded songs. Mm-hmm. So there is a bunch of this information out there. And I worry when the more of this type of stuff we have, the more security concerns there are. So not only does it raise up questions about should this data be shared, but is it being secured and protected?
So the security, I understand. But the other is like in terms of assessing risk, this is a person, the person whose insurance anecdotally was raised 21%. This is a person that never had an accident, didn't have tickets, didn't have any of the other red flags that make your insurance go up. This was something on a different sliding scale that said, you know what, you're a riskier driver because you accelerate a little too fast or you brake a little hard. And I think that when you're starting to say what, like when you make it harder and harder to be a safe driver, even though your record's been clean the entire time, like, I don't know, I think that's a little too subjective.
But then safe gets to be a relative term.
Well, I mean,
just because you weren't in an accident or you weren't caught speeding doesn't mean you're a safe driver. We see that every single day. I mean, there are people who don't get caught and don't get in crashes. Doesn't mean they're good drivers.
I don't know. I think that it's a little too subjective in terms of what they're giving away. And I also think that it's inappropriate for an insurance company to raise your premium based on that information, like a 6-month snapshot. I don't know. And I also, if you're like, it's one thing when you opt in, like when I switched my insurance, I had the ability to opt in, plug the thing into my car and get like a $5 or 5% savings that you could continue to accrue savings in the event that, you know, everything was perfect. But based off my experience driving another friend's car that had that specific plug in, and I opted out of that. I just think that with this information that can be harvested, packaged, sold, and used against you to cost you thousands, when you're talking about your insurance premiums going up 20%, you're talking about significant money. Mm-hmm. And like that could change your entire budget. That could change whether or not you buy another car, a new car versus a used car. And it'll certainly, like Doug says, be whether or not you buy a GM car, which Doug says he wouldn't. With you, Doug. Doug also says, thought about getting a Bolt EUV before they stopped making them because they were so expensive, but the charging ability was so slow they killed it. Now, knowing this, I'm really glad no Bolt. That's right, Doug. Just helping reinforce your initial thoughts.
Well, you know, the other thing, David, you can always read the stuff and opt out of it.
Well, that's the other thing is that, like, I understand, well, you can't opt out of things in terms and conditions. Terms and conditions are yes or no. Like you can opt out of specific features when they're like the little buttons mm-hmm. or the boxes below where it's like, hey, can we do this? Yes or no. Can we do that? Yes or no. And I was thinking when we are trading information, we've seen new rules come out where that needs to be a little bit more spelled out, a little more explicit. Like when you close on a house and it's just very plain English. This is what we're taking. This is what you're giving. And this is how it's being used. I don't know. I think maybe we got to have a model like that more rather than just blanket accept terms and conditions.
I agree with you there. I'm just saying there's also benefits to this type of data exchange, as long as we keep it safe.
Hockey Boy 383, I think that's a new reader, or just, you know, switched up the name, recommended that you lock all of your credit reports. And don't forget the second tier credit reports like LexisNexis and the three major reporting agencies. Once they're locked, no information can be sent to requesters. I mean, the other thing, though, is that, you know, when you do that, you don't get any credit. So it's great that you can lock off that information. But like, I would assume the same thing here, that if you were to lock out your insurance companies from this information, they'll just be like, OK, well, we're not going to insure you. You know, I don't know. I also think that, you know, it's a little forward thinking, but auto insurance companies kind of got to get it while the getting is good, because we are on a path towards autonomy where a lot of auto insurance as it currently stands will be rendered obsolete probably within our lifetime still.
Oh, I can't believe that.
Auto insurance?
I mean, just like as we know auto insurance, like it is going to change once we see more and more autonomous cars on the road.
Obsolete?
Yeah,
it's going to be obsolete.
People still steal cars.
David, can you guys clip this out and then send it to me in 25 years, please?
Okay, timestamp it.
Okay.
Also, when there David has no 401k.
Yeah.
That was a fad as well.
It is a fad.
It's a fad as well.
And when you guys are comfortably retired and you can visit me while I'm working the produce section at Pick and Save at 75, just being like, just trying to pay the bills.
And we'll be like, why is your car so beat up?
Yeah, you're just like making it rain with 401k money.
Yeah.
You're like, mm-hmm. And I'll be like, yeah, I'm still driving the beater because I can't trust anything.
I will buy all the Honeycrisp apples organic.
Frank Pasquale, he is a law professor at Cornell University, said he was surprised by this tactic. He told the Times that it was, quote, not within the reasonable expectation of the average consumer, and it should be certainly be prominently disclosed. So at least I got someone on my side. All right.
I'm on your side.
I know. I'm on your side. But, you know, okay, I get it. I get it.
The insurance obsolete thing. It's
going to be obsolete. You know what? Yeah, cut it out. 25 years, maybe 30. Maybe 30 years, send it out.
All right.
Okay. Well, before we jump into, in case you missed it, we have another word from our sponsor.
My name is Jeff Ranke. I'm the editorial director for Manufacturing.net, industrial equipment news, and manufacturing business technology. I'll be joined by Dave McGovern and James Englehart from Office MDT to discuss various topics and provide takeaways on how you can be more efficient in the areas of OT data management control, version control, vulnerability protection, and much more. It's my pleasure to introduce Dave and Jim. Dave McGowan has 10 years of experience providing automation, change management, and disaster recovery solutions. He manages some of Office MDT's largest enterprise accounts and is especially passionate about helping customers implement the best OT backup and cybersecurity strategies. Jim Englehart has been working in the controls world for 35 years. He has a BS in both chemical engineering and electrical engineering and has worked in the refining and chemical, engineering consulting, and food and beverage areas before settling in as head of pre-sales engineering, professional services, and support for the Americas at Office MDT. He's also a member of the Office MDT product team.
And we're back. The Secrets of OT Data Management is an exclusive new video podcast for manufacturers looking to stay ahead of the curve in today's digital landscape. Join Office MDT's Dave McGovern and Jim Englehart, along with Jeff Ranke, as they unveil the secrets of data management for manufacturers. You can learn effective OT data management, control, cybersecurity, implementation, shortcuts, more. Watch it now. All right, in case you missed it, story's not as popular on our websites, but still stand to make a big impact on the industry going forward. What do you have for us this week, Anna?
I selected a story titled Chemours Execs Allegedly Manipulate Cash Flow to Influence Bonus Pay. I was actually kind of surprised this didn't make the top five this week.
I was shocked this didn't make the top five.
All right. Well, in case you missed it, everybody, 1 week after chemical company and the maker of Teflon, Chemours, made headlines for placing its CEO, CFO, and controller and principal accounting officer on administrative leave, it was confirmed that the execs were accused of participating in efforts to make the company's cash flow look more appealing than they actually were. The execs reportedly looked to delay payments to vendors that were supposed to be made at the end of 2023. Simultaneously, they sought receivables that were not due until the beginning of 2024. The committee also found that similar actions occurred in 2022. The increased cash flow measures included publicly communicated free cash flow targets, a metric that determines executive officers' incentive compensations. For example, the salary for on-leave CEO Mark Newman totaled approximately $996,000 in 2022. However, other earnings, including non-equity incentive plan compensation or variable compensation, right? Mm-hmm. And stock awards brought his total pay to nearly $7.7 million that year.
Oh, it's a swing.
It was a big swing. You know, it's always contentious when we cover topics of executive comp. We did this recently and everyone's always very divided about it, especially when these pay packages feel outrageous or at least dramatically higher than what everyone else in the company is making. And often the defense is, they hit these financial targets. It's variable. It's based on performance. I think stories like these are a good reminder that the parties involved may have a bit more influence on these targets.
The thumb on the scale.
Yeah, like funny accounting on how the P&Ls are reported or pushing expenses into a new calendar year, which seems egregious, but something that these execs were able to get away with for actually a couple of years. My point is that there are ways in which these hard number financial goals can be manipulated. And the people who are in the position to do it are often the ones who benefit the most from doing it. Mm-hmm. And so just something to think about, I think, considering how we incentivize these execs and if we make it tempting to use poor judgment because there is such a heavy financial motivator. I think that's what we saw in this case. And I'm not saying this happens frequently, but it is kind of scary to see it laid out this way. And you think, wow, how easy would it be to do that and make a ton of money off it? And then it was really the board that kind of figured it out. But, mm-hmm. You know, maybe that doesn't happen.
No,
in other cases.
I was surprised that it was a company like Chemours. And I mean, man, those executive management meetings have got to be going quick, right? Now. Just, you know, like one guy just like, yeah. All right.
Just me
waiting
today.
For everybody to get back and replace them. I do think that this story was a good example of how, like, there can be a little bit of creative accounting happening behind the scenes. And, I mean, you're right. When you're talking about, I mean, the guy had a, what, $6.7 million incentive to maybe float some things into 24 and then bring some things into 23. So I get it. And it's something that, if anything, if it helps raise awareness on that sort of thing, and maybe catch it going forward, I think that's a good thing. Jeff, you don't think it's a good thing?
I would agree.
Oh, I thought you were smiling. I'm like, what is he coming out against it? Like,
no, just drop it in there. I think that's a good thing.
Yeah.
I'd agree.
Hey, if they can figure out how to do it.
If they can do it the right way.
Then they've earned it.
That is a good thing.
If you're not cheating, you're not trying. Just like.
So this had to go against, like, what do they call it? The generally acceptable accounting principles or something like that.
The app?
Yeah. Which is why those things are in place. They're not necessarily like regulations or anything, but they're agreed upon ways of doing things, standards, which is a good thing,
a
David.
A good thing.
We should have those. Yep.
Yeah. Yes. Right, is your thing going to be a good thing that leads to a good thing?
I don't know. Mine definitely will be. I mean, well, maybe. I don't know. It's a mess. No, this was wild. And I'm just kind of curious because they like already paid this out, right? Like these are bonuses they had already received. So
this was for the 1 million to 7.7. That was a 2022 figure. So that's already.
Yeah. So,
I mean, they could claw it back.
Claw that back.
Yeah.
Well, and how does that guy ever get a job again?
Probably pretty easily.
Probably does.
Yeah. He's probably already hired somewhere just working as a consultant. Just like, hey, you know what? I mean, come on. Every once in a while, everybody gets their hand cut in the cookie jar. You know what I mean? We're all trying to do our best here. But look at all the good things I did.
That's how he sounds?
That's how he sounds. Look at all the good things I did. Come on. It's a huge company. Teflon. Big.
Wow.
Everybody
likes Teflon. I didn't know they hired somebody from the cast of Sopranos.
That's exactly who he was. I'm pretty sure that's a pretty accurate character portrait there.
Okay.
All right. Mine, in case you missed it this week, was a hydrogen fuel cell maker, Nel ASA, gets another $75 million in Michigan. And this is just me kind of following that hydrogen thread, but in a microgrid way, not a vehicle way, which I know we all love and appreciate and support. So I mentioned Nel last week, but this Norwegian fuel cell manufacturer, Nel, yesterday announced cash incentives and grants totaling about $75 million from the U.S. Department of Energy and the state of Michigan for the company's electrolyzer production facility in the state. According to Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, the plant could create 500 jobs in Plymouth, which is near Detroit. Nel is going to make its next generation electrolyzer technologies, PEM stacks or PEM stacks, and pressurized alkaline stacks. These are used in hydrogen production. The PEM stacks are actually currently being developed in partnership with GM. I hear that they're actually going to harvest your information from the PEM stacks and then use it against you and charge you more for these microgrids.
Yep.
Last week, I talked about how Nel recently partnered with Southern Company and GM on an integrated hydrogen microgrid pilot project, that's a mouthful, at a power plant in Georgia. The DOE granted Nel $50 million in direct investment support for the planned U.S. gigafactory. The state kicked in another $25 million. Part of the investment, too, includes partnerships with GM, Macomb County, our community college, and Wayne State University's College of Engineering to create a manufacturing training program. I picked this because it seems like, other than the huge investment that the DOE just made in hydrogen infrastructure, this is something that appears to be, I don't want to call it a groundswell yet, but like I said, a thread, and seems to have applicability, as we've said, in terms of fleets and on-plant infrastructure. And I think it's really cool. I also think it's really cool that part of the investment goes to training a potential workforce to work on this kind of technology because, I don't know, I hear electrolyzer and I think maybe not that easy to make. And then I see a picture of one and I'm like, definitely not easy to make. One thing that kind of stood out to me, though, was that Nel's CEO said the investment is going to help commercialize the company's products. Good, right? Go from R&D to the commercializing phase. But then the company said it hasn't made a final investment decision on the facility, which is going to depend on market demand for the technology. And that one was a weird one for me on the release, where it's just like, we are grateful to have this $75 million. They've already received another $50 million from the state to build this facility. And then at the end, they're just like, we'll see. But I don't know if you guys had a chance to read this story. It just came out yesterday, but Jeff, either way, it's kind of cool to see advancements in potential hydrogen microgrids. I don't know. Maybe move a step forward.
Well, absolutely. And I think if I was going to read into his comments, I think we're still figuring it out a little bit with hydrogen in terms of the applications.
Yeah.
We know it's friendlier from a usage perspective. The production element of it is still difficult and still something that has a lot of challenges ingrained with it. So it is encouraging to see this because long term, there are a lot of benefits, whether it's a microgrid, an on-plant energy source, as opposed to maybe taking some of that burden off of the electrical grid, or a power plant type application, again, getting away from fossil fuels. So there's a lot of huge potential here. But I think to pinpoint, I mean, I know they're going to be building these electrolyzers and stuff like that, but also to pinpoint more specifically exactly what they're going to be doing with the plant, the size of it, the scope of it, that could be very much figuring out as we go a little bit, which isn't necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah.
So.
No, it's agreed. It's probably better than dropping the $1.25 billion like they did in Georgia. Anna, your thoughts on the developments going on in Michigan?
It's cool. It sounds very futuristic.
Is it a good thing?
I think it's a good thing that leads to maybe another good thing.
Oh my God, it's spreading. It's catching. It's contagious.
It's contagious. It just sounds, this whole thing sounds like it's out of a comic book to me.
Because it's an electrolyzer.
Get me the electrolyzer. Take it to the alkaline stacks.
We must pursue the electrolyzer technology.
Yeah, there's
the only way to win.
So, some evil villain. I don't know who the evil villain is. Nel, I guess.
It's not a good thing all of a sudden. She put Luther in the CEO chair.
As we covered last week, the commercial application of this type of fuel technology is, I don't think, compelling at this point, but closed loop, microgrid type stuff. Yes, I totally agree. I think there's a lot that can be done there. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. Obviously, it will be interesting for even Nell's CEO to see how this plays out.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, we'll see. It might be, if there's demand, I guess we'll make some.
Yeah.
But to Jeff's point, that's kind of where we're at with it. So what do you do?
Well, and I understand, like, when picking, and in case you missed it, it shouldn't just be like, yeah, what we just said. In case you missed it. Yeah, we see episode 160. All right, done.
Bring me the electrolyzer.
Jeff, what's your in case you missed it this week?
I don't know if I can follow that one. I don't have any comic book references here.
This could be a comic book.
So I picked a story talking about the UAW Southern strategy and basically what it's talking about. It's something we've discussed before in terms of coming off of the big wins that they had off of the last strike. Now really focusing on a lot of those plants that have really just kind of blown up over the last 25 years in the southeastern part of the country. And the UAW making a concerted push. The thing that's working against them right now, we've talked a little bit about this too, but they went into a lot more depth in the article about the three-legged stool sort of that's been positive in drawing a lot of these, not just the OEs, but with the OEs also comes all of those suppliers and all of the affiliated industries with the automotive and building that infrastructure. So they always talk about having a great workforce, being able to people that are ready to work, also a very friendly working environment, which includes no unions. Mm-hmm. So if we bring those unions in, what does that mean for the future of a lot of these facilities down in this part of the country? And they talk about the UAW's 30-50-70 rule, which I guess I hadn't heard before, but they talk about workers signing union cards. And once it hits 30% at a factory, the UAW announces publicly that they're organizing a campaign. At the 50% mark, it holds a public rally that'll even get you Sean Fain down there.
Whoa. Okay.
And at 70%, that's when they seek voluntary recognition by management, at which point if management doesn't, then it goes to the National Labor Relations Board and becomes a much bigger deal. One of the things that's also interesting here is in order for any of these things to come to fruition, over half of the workers at the facility need to participate in a vote. Mm-hmm. So even if they're against it or for it, they still have to vote in the election for it to be recognized. I think it's interesting in terms of the progress that they've made down there. They've said of the 13 non-union facilities that they're targeting, they've got two where they've obtained the support of more than half of the workers at the factory, looking specifically at the VW plant in Chattanooga and a Mercedes-Benz factory in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. So there has been some headway there. Mm-hmm. Personally, it would be very interesting if this ever comes to fruition, what would be the long-term impact? Because if a lot of these automakers, which are primarily foreign automakers, you're looking at Nissan, VW, Mercedes-Benz, Toyota, many others, they start having to deal with labor relations, just like they do in their country of origin, so to speak.
Yeah.
And they're paying higher labor rates than, say, Mexico, where they wouldn't have to worry about those things.
Yeah.
What is the long-term perspective there? Perspectives there is having a union facility, which is meant to help these workers get better rates, have more job security, ensure they have benefits for the long term, is that also going to be a turnoff potentially to these companies that came here mm-hmm. because they wouldn't have to deal with unions?
Yeah.
So what is the fallout? Is the fallout, it's just going to make everything better because you're going to have more secure workforce, or is it going to make these companies start to question their place in this geography? Especially again, with Mexico being very, very close. Mexico has seen automotive production ramp up by more than 10% over the last 3 years, each year individually. So it's continuing to produce more and more stuff. And you know, as soon as the automakers go down there, the supply chain is going to follow them. All those suppliers will go with them as well. So it just brings about, like, is the UAW doing what it should? Do we want the UAW to ultimately be successful? Or do we want things to just to stay the way they are? I don't know what the answer is here because it's hard to say that the UAW didn't help these workers because we know they did. As soon as the UAW members got that pay increase, so did everyone else. Mm-hmm. So they did benefit from it. And overall, that presence in the marketplace was beneficial in this instance. I haven't always been a fan of the UAW. Obviously, it's got a legacy of corrupt and criminal behavior. But, it's a very interesting sort of time in history when it comes to what's going on with this union in this geography. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
No, I think it's hard to say that the UAW sort of has to like tread lightly because the UAW leadership is more of a blunt object in terms of strategy. But I do think that they could bring a lot of good and if we could get to a level, like there's a lot of unrest still right now. You know, Ford's still really itchy with UAW right now. And I think once things settle and we can kind of have a symbiotic relationship, I think it could be good. I think it could be good for workers and companies down there. Anna, what are your thoughts on the UAW's Southern strategy?
Yeah, I think you both raise a lot of good points. I mean, it's certainly something that you need to keep in the back of your head of what is maybe an unintended consequence. However, I do think that's what they want that to be a deterrent, right? The automakers. And I also think the other thing you have to remember is, like, I don't think Volkswagen and Mercedes and stuff only came over here because they didn't want to deal with the unions. I mean, there's other benefits to being on American soil with your production. There are, you know, regulatory things. There are tax incentives. There are, you don't have to deal with the border. Mm-hmm. Your closer proximity to certain markets than Mexico is, many markets in the United States. So there's a lot more, I think, there than just saying, like, it is either a non-union South plant or Mexico. I think it's a little more complex than that. But yeah, I mean, I certainly do agree that it could be a factor in this. And, you know, you've seen a lot of automotive companies start to move South. And if the benefit of doing that disappears at some point, then there may be some shifts.
They'll keep going South.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Who knows?
Well, I would recommend this article because there are a couple of points here that, you know, the article is just too big to get into in case you missed it. But one was, like, I was surprised with how politically charged some of the unionization efforts became in the South, in terms of, like, where governors came out and just flat out said, you know, made threats.
And it crossed party lines. That's what was interesting to me as well.
So I would definitely recommend reading UAW's Southern Strategy just to get a better idea of the full picture as to what's going on and kind of the implications surrounding it. All right, let's get into final thoughts before we get out of here. Anna, what's your final thought?
Okay, so today, right before the podcast began, David gave me a TV show recommendation, which I immediately shot down.
Yes, just dead in the water.
Because it doesn't sound like something I'd be into. It was what's called Yellow Jackets.
Yellow Jackets, yes. Yeah. We just finished season two, and it's a wild one.
So I do need to start. We do need to start, like, a new thing.
Yeah,
but
you're looking for something new, just certainly not that.
No, I wanted to say is I'm getting out of my comfort zone is a good thing, I think, and I have done that a few times in the last couple of years with great results. So I'm going to try to just go with whatever. So if anyone's got recommendations, I've seen very little. So you don't assume that I've already seen it because I probably haven't.
If you say everyone's seen that, it's like except
for me, probably haven't. So feel free to send those along. That would be great. And I'll give Yellow Jackets a try.
Give it a try. You know, it's not, like I said, it's not a binging show. I didn't binge it because it's just like, you know what? I'm going to take one. We're going to analyze what happened. We're going to talk about it. We're going to quietly watch a comedy.
Okay.
Get it out of the system a little bit. But my wife liked it because it was a story that you never saw told from a female perspective. That type of story.
Okay.
Doug says, watch Daredevil. Agree with Doug.
Yes. What is that, a movie or a show?
It's a show now on Disney.
Well, you can watch the original one on Netflix too. That one's actually really good too.
No, it's not on Netflix anymore. It all shifted to Disney.
Okay. Well, yeah, check it out there.
I haven't.
Okay. Yeah. That's pretty good.
Okay.
Fantastic.
My final thought. My final thoughts this week were last weekend's a bunch of friends got together for the annual Arnie Zirbel Memorial Bowl Off, which was a good reminder that, A, even playing nine pin, I'm not a bowler. And it was also a good reminder that sometimes, you know, if the shirts are a little thin, you need an undershirt. Otherwise, the team photo is nearly unpostable because it's so nippular. And it's also a good reminder that getting together with friends to fight a good cause, which is, actually, the Memorial Bowl Off is named after a good friend's father. He was the first fundraiser. It was for him, Arnie Zirbel. But every year they pick a different family and raise a bunch of money for these families that are fighting cancer. And this one in particular happened to be like a pro local bowler. So the bowling alley was bananas.
Oh, man.
They needed like a circus tent full of raffles, to which I only won one. And it was not great.
Not a second t-shirt, which is what you really needed.
Yes. Not a second t-shirt, which is what we all as a group needed. You know, it's like when you go to take that.
Did you have like a Fanatics jersey type situation?
It was a Fanatics jersey type situation where like we all went to, you know, every year we take a photo, everyone together. And it's just like, but like everyone wanted to stand behind everybody. Just like, yeah. You know what? You get in front. Ah, you get in front.
Why don't you turn the flash off?
Yeah. But you know, just like when these opportunities come up, it's good to go out and like support friends and family. And for any cause, you know, it really makes a big difference, even if you're just buying a $5 packet of raffle tickets, to which you can win a package of dog treats that I didn't even remember putting it in the bucket. The other was that, you know, we mentioned it was Pi Day. I was kind of curious, is Pi Day like the original STEM day? Because it was like the first time, in like grade school when they emphasized mathematics and then everyone like as a competition tried to see how much of pi they could memorize.
Oh, and we didn't do that.
Yeah, like, I was going to say, when did Pi Day become a thing?
Yeah.
Like probably around like fifth or sixth grade for me. Actually, it was probably middle school. Where like all of a sudden I was like, hold on a second. There's a Pi Day and you're going to bring us pizza and pie and all I got to do is math?
Is that when you started to hate fruit-filled pies?
No, it was long before that. Long before.
Whoa.
Wasn't the connection to math?
No. I'm weirdly good at math. But like it was one of those things where they're just like, you should pursue a career in this. And I'm just like, I will never do that. Nope. Sorry. But I don't know. I just thought it was cool. It was like, in my memory, it was like the original STEM day because they never emphasized science, technology, and math outside of like a science fair. And like Pi Day was the first STEM memory that I had, which is like, what is it? Like revisionist history. It's not like when I first happened, I'm like, you know what? This is a good STEM education, STEM curriculum. Only in hindsight. Jeff, what's your final thought this week?
Wheel of Time on Amazon is also a sleeper, pretty good series.
Wheel of Time?
Wheel of Time. Okay.
Is it about time travel?
No.
Oh, okay.
Really?
No, not really.
Oh, okay. No.
I liked it. It's a sci-fi thing. But
you have to ask.
If you got into Game of Thrones, you could make the leap for this one.
Okay. It's called Wheel of Time, I feel like, asking about time
travel. Rosamund Pike, she's pretty good.
All right. Yeah. All right. Yeah.
Okay.
Is she the woman from Gone Girl?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Never going to be able to see her differently. Never.
Well, what about We Care? Or I Care a Lot. She did that one, too.
Oh, yeah.
She was horrible in that one. Yeah.
Yeah. That one was good.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, closing thought. So about 2 weeks ago, I started to see a chiropractor. I was having some lower back pain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you know how they always talk about those people being miracle workers?
Mm-hmm.
My back pain is gone.
Really?
Like I was having issues like bending down, even like standing here for a while. If you saw me squirming a little bit up here, that's why.
Yeah.
And it was different because in the past when I've gone to a chiropractor, it's the cracking, bending, all that kind of stuff. But these chiropractors, it's very, very like targeted and very subtle. And the weird thing is the first two times I went there, I felt like I was back playing high school football or I've been in a car accident or something. Like my whole body was just like hurting, like it didn't feel right. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden it just kind of came together. So, because I'm the type of person when something's quote unquote broken, I just want to fix it.
Yeah.
And I was pretty shocked at how subtle the treatment was and how the positive effects were. So we're talking about like chronic pain stuff before. It kind of got me thinking about that. And this one's worked out. So
good, Jeff.
Give the chiropractor a shot because they definitely work.
I'm going to need a recommendation because the last time I went to mine, my shoulder's never been the same. And
of course,
like he went under. I was just like, oh, I'll have to go see him again to see if he can fix it. It's a Chinese restaurant now. That's not a good sign.
Your chiropractor went out of business.
Yeah, he fled. Like,
can you do all of us a favor?
No, never. No.
You should never pick a service provider on your own ever.
Ever.
Yeah.
Because you never get, I'm sorry, you never get it right.
No, I'm just out there, you know, someone's got to write the 1-star reviews. I'm just out there just like, hey, this one's not for everybody.
I mean, maybe your dentist is totally a great dentist.
Oh, they're good. They're great.
That was all you?
No, dentist is great. Oh, yeah. No, I told you. Fluoride, man. Well water. It's on me.
Because, I mean, that, the house improvements.
Yep, that's on Home Depot.
There's been some other stuff.
Yeah, like every time you're like, yeah, I heard about this great new restaurant, and I went there, and then they served me a rat. Like, That's never happened to anyone except for you.
I mean, no, those are just the stories no one remembers when it's just like, how was your weekend? It was great. I did this. It was wonderful. But everyone remembers when I'm like, my God, you won't believe what happens.
That happens a lot, though.
I went to the library and they charged me for
stuff,
a book.
I ordered this stuff from Amazon and it came in, all of it was open and there were cookies eaten.
They were crushed and it was ridiculous. Anyway.
So I will reference this chiropractor.
Okay.
And you, because my wife referred them to me and I was maybe a little skeptical because, again, I was waiting for the whole crack and everything else and not that, but definitely works.
No, my wife Carrie is also like probably in the exact same stage where she's still in the car accident stage of a new chiropractor. And I was just kind of waiting in the weeds, like, was it going to be all right? Because I would like to. The first time I've had success with chiropractors, it was just that last time I was like, all right, everything's broken again. And actually, talking about Carrie, I got to give her the credit for sending that. She was the one that put that GM, the insurance story on my radar.
Oh.
And I definitely thought when she sent it to me at first, it was like a passive-aggressive play. Like, hey, just so you know, you should probably know that they're going to be watching this a little closer.
The king of hard breaking over here.
All right. Before we get out of here.
Not wrong.
The king of
what?
Not
wrong.
Hard breaking. Oh, come on. I don't know. Do I hard?
Okay.
I break
that's
hard?
That is the second time Eric has just kind of popped his head up. Like usually he's real focused on his producer responsibilities.
Eric knows.
All right. But it's kind of like when you said you're good at math. We saw Eric go.
Yeah. I know. Like this whole time we've had Good Will Hunting on our podcast. We didn't know.
No.
You never once mentioned this?
No, it's not like I'm not like that good at math. It was just like one of those things that was like easy in high school. It's not like I've pursued a secretive life of like mathematics. And okay, sure. If like 3 out of 5 people in the studio think you break hard, but I mean, I stand by. Still a clean record. Just gonna knock on all the wood. Before we get out of here, please make sure to like, share, and subscribe to the podcast. You can also help us out a lot by leaving the podcast a positive review on whatever platform you use. If you want to email the podcast, you can reach any of us at David, Jeff, or Anna at IEN.com with email the podcast in the subject line. You can also subscribe to our daily and weekly newsletters. Make sure you get it delivered to your inbox first. And subscribe on YouTube at IEN Magazine so you can join us live every Thursday at 2 p.m. For Jeff Ranke and Anna Wells, I'm David Manti. This is the Today in Manufacturing podcast, and we'll see you next week.